We're just kibitzing. I mean, you know, we're just sitting right here. I don't know what the problem. What? I don't, you know.
I'm ready.
Oh, wait, the music. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart.
Every week, we connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture, and frankly, whatever else crosses our minds, but that, you know, the producers aren't supposed to know that. But, you know, anyway.
Nope. We try to pretend we're going to stay on topic. We're definitely going to. Man. I believe it's your fault, everyone, because none of us is off topic as all of us.
Get it?
No,
get
no,
it? See
smart.
What we did there?
That's what
see
I meant
what
to say.
We did there? All right. So, look, here's a date I want you to keep in mind, and it's a very big date in my house. November the 1st, actually, is a big date in my house because that's when my 17-year-old high school senior kid has to have a bunch of early decision. I can't actually remember if it's early decision or early action. But either way, the early part of the college application season starts the 1st of November. And that's a very big deal in my house because we are going to talk today about how to pay for college.
Ugh. Yeah, I wish that we had had this show. Well, and when I say we, like, I mean my mom. Hi, Mom. Yeah. I
Does
wish
mom
my
listen?
Mom had had the episode that we're about to... Oh, God, no.
Oh.
My mom, bless her heart, a long time ago came to visit me at work. This is just terrible. Introduced herself to my then podcast co-host and was like, great to meet you. I don't listen to the show.
Oh, there we go. So it's all good.
So that was...
So we're safe. We're safe super. On both maternal
So
counts.
At least we're all on the same page. Yeah, we can say whatever we want.
Yep.
So I really wish that we had had this show when I was both applying for and going to college because it... What I'm astonished to hear is that lo these many years, but not that many years later, it is still as confusing. And by it, I mean how much college actually costs compared to how much it says it costs, the loan situation, the scholarship grant, private loan thing, what people can afford. And evidently, it's just not getting any better. So to find out for sure whether it is or is not any better, our producer, Sharon Morris, went out and met a few actual high school students here in Los Angeles through an organization called Minds Matter LA, which is this nonprofit that helps local students that I also wish I had had. It helps them get college ready, in particular, kids from families that don't have high incomes or a lot of experience with higher education. And full disclosure here, it's actually run by somebody who used to work at Marketplace, our former head of business operations, Tina Admins, who left us to like do good work for kids.
Yeah, she tried to do a full-time job here and Minds Matter LA on the side, and it was too much. Anyway, so Sharon went out and talked to a couple of three people. Valerie Castellanos says her top choice is Scripps College, part of the Claremont Colleges out near L.A. Junie Arden is interested in Barnard and Dartmouth. Priscilla Rodriguez is eyeing Columbia and Yale. Oh, my gosh. Ambitious, also expensive. Sharon talked to them about applying and a bunch of stuff. Here's Valerie. She's done her app, FAFSA, which is the Federal Financial Aid Form. Also something called CSS. It's a private college aid form. And now she's just kind of waiting.
So the reason I chose a private school was because they usually give better financial aid. And it's like 100% need met. There are Cal States and UCs, but they really don't give as much financial aid as I would need. I'm applying to a lot of scholarships. It's pretty tough, especially when it comes to rejections for scholarships, because it's kind of like each rejection from a scholarship is like, how am I going to do this? What if I can't afford to go to college? And it's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, it's rough, right? You figure out your dream school, you get in, and then you can't make the money work, and that's horrible.
Yeah. I also, just the word FAFSA is giving me flashbacks. Just horrible ones. I mean, it's awful. And the amount of stress that families go through, you can hear that in her voice. And in this case, these young women are doing most of this without help from family. They are the ones who are tracking down their parents' tax forms, their employment history, tracking the FAFSA and scholarship deadlines. and Minds Matter LA helps them with all of that. Junie says, our next interviewee, says that if you ask whether her parents understand all of her hard work and struggle to be a competitive college applicant, the answer is no.
Okay, so like when you asked that question, I automatically thought like I could really explain to my mom what AP classes are. And now I'm in this position where I'm a 17-year-old explaining to a 40-year-old about these financial things that I could barely even understand. And it's not only about how they didn't go to college, but most of us here also, like our parents are immigrant parents. So it's two different, completely different worlds. Why it matters that I'm taking challenging classes, why it matters that I'm staying after school for I don't know how many hours to do extracurriculars, and I have to explain to them that all of that is because we need it, because we need the money.
So you got your full rides, right? Full scholarships. They go mm-hmm. to, generally speaking, the most high-achieving students. Everybody else has some combination of federal or private loans, maybe some grants, and whatever the family can afford. Priscilla Rodriguez, her top picks are Columbia and Yale, tuition at both. I'm just going to throw out a number here, which is pretty close to accurate. My guess would be for the 2018-19 school year, it's like $75,000 all in, right?
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That is, let me just tell you that is a very well-educated yes on my part. But here's the thing. Priscilla knows that private schools might actually give her a better deal than state schools, depending on how she stacks up on merit, right? Her academics. Mm. And for completely foreseeable reasons, she can't imagine being able to pay anything close to that full sticker price.
You think about like some of the prices of these private institutions, they're really insane. You know, their tuition costs as much as, you know, someone's income. And if you can afford that school, you can go to that school. But if you can't afford it, you're bound to go to this school. You know, education should be accessible to all, and it is. But then why is there that economic difference? It's something that's definitely comes to mind when you start researching and applying to these colleges.
Median income in the United States is like $53,000, y'all. So think about $75,000 for 1 year.
And the average debt, I mean, not for nothing, but there's a Wharton podcast out today asking whether the student debt crisis could slow the U.S. economy, because then they come out. What do you say the median income is? Like,
median income
come
in the
out
United
with an
States
average.
Median income is $53,000, right? Yeah.
Yep. And these students are coming out with an average of $37,000 worth of debt, but a lot of them have a lot more than that.
It is bananas.
It's bananas.
Anyway, so the question we wanted to get at on this episode is, why is the price of college not really so high? Because that's a different thing. But why is it so complicated, right? The price is not actually the price, as you'll hear. And the process is so opaque and frankly, crazy-making. So what we did was we got Kim Clark on the phone. She has been looking at college tuition for years and years. She's the assistant director of the Education Writers Association. And we got her on the phone. Hey, Kim. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for hanging in through our long preamble there, the throat clearing. But we wanted to set the stage.
Yeah. And I mean, what do you think exactly? Like, to that point, what do you think when you hear Junie and Priscilla and Valerie talk about their experience just trying to figure out what college is going to cost, let alone what they can afford?
Right, right. Well, first of all, I heard some things that I wanted to give them a call and tell them, maybe don't just apply to private schools, because they're making certain assumptions that, for example, all private schools are generous with aid. And that's certainly not true. I mean, that's definitely not true. Mm-hmm. And it's not true, especially for low-income kids. So I guess one of the main points that, you know, they need to know, and it sounds like they do know, is that there's a huge difference between a college's sticker price, which is the price that they advertise on their website, which, you know, Kai correctly pointed out for Columbia is something like $75,000 mm-hmm. a year, in part because it's in New York and living costs are so high, and the actual price that people pay after they subtract out scholarship and grants. And in the college world, that's known as the net price. And maybe when you're going shopping, you might think of that as the discounted price. You know, maybe that's or the sale price is another way to think about it. You know, at private colleges, only about 10 to 30% of the students typically pay the sticker price. On average, it's 10%, but at schools like Columbia, it might be like 30 or 40% because it's such a high-demand school.
Right.
And at public schools, maybe 50 to 60% of students get aid. And so, you know, 40 to 50% pay those sticker prices.
Can we break down some definitions here for a minute? You say $75,000, and that's tuition. But really, there's a whole bunch of subcategories, right? Could you go through the line items?
Right. So $75,000 is not just tuition. People talk about tuition, and that's only just the cost that you pay for the coursework. There are many more costs associated with college. There's fees, for example. A lot of, if you take science classes, you have a lot of lab fees, for example. And more colleges are adding these sneaky fees like gym fees and, all, you know, student success fees and all these crazy fees.
I'd like a student success fee, please. I'd like a radio host success fee.
It's like $25 to check a bag. Like, that's what we're talking here? That's absurd.
No, just because they don't want to raise tuition, so they add an extra fee that nobody's ever heard of. Then there's books. I mean, you know, especially if you're taking science classes, you can easily pay $100, $200 for each textbook. On average, people are paying about $1,200 a year, just in addition to tuition and fees, for the books they need to succeed in class. And then there's the issue of living costs. If you're not living at home, living in a dorm and buying, you know, meals at the cafeteria, that's typically between $8,000 and $13,000 a year, depending on where you are. And then there's transportation to get to and from campus. I mean, so when you hear these $75,000 numbers, that's the all-in cost.
Why? Okay, so there's that. First of all, it's really hard to figure out how much you might have to pay and when and where and to whom. But then what about this hodgepodge of ways to pay? Between family money and grants and loans and scholarships and maybe private, maybe not in terms of scholarships. Why is that also so confusing?
Right. Well, I mean, basically what we have is a system that as prices have risen, we've been trying to fix it with these little tiny Band-Aids. And one little foundation has a little grant or another little foundation has a little, you know, low interest loan. Everybody's trying to fix it with little tiny fixes. And so it's incredibly It's like we're you know, stitching together this ragged quilt rather than having a complete overhaul and simplification. So there's a million little scholarship programs, as you mentioned. Every college has its own scholarship system. Mm-hmm. I mean, some, and each one has its own wacky scholarships. I mean, Juniata has a college scholarship of $1,000 for left-handed students. You know,
I want that one. I'm a lefty. Sorry.
The Tall Club of America has a scholarship for tall students, you know, and I mean, so there's all these.
There's one for me, too.
Okay. So there are some big programs like, you know, the federal Pell Grant, which goes to low income students. And you're in California. The Cal Grant is very good because it gives lots of low income, high achieving students, you know, lots of aid. So there's lots of different. Everybody's trying to pitch in and solve it. So there, everybody has a little bit of money. Nobody has enough to really solve the problem. So there's lots of different grants and scholarships. And then there's a lot of confusion about loans. Kai, you mentioned federal private loans. Those are two different things. There's federal loans and there's private sector loans. And adding to the confusion is a company like Sallie Mae, which used to be federal. And so everybody thinks in their mind that it's a, you know, still somehow part of the federal government. It was privatized years ago. So people think when they're getting a Sallie Mae loan, maybe they're getting a special deal because it's from the federal government. It's been private for years. Those Sallie Mae loans are just, you know, just as expensive as the loan from Wells Fargo. Or, I mean, it's just a private company. There's no financial aid associated with Sallie Mae anymore. But they don't remember that. They don't remember that it was spun off.
This reminds me of nothing as much as it does remind me of healthcare and how the costs are almost, it can't possibly be that they're deliberately opaque, but it sure looks like they're deliberately opaque. I you know, I mean, if I went to, you know, the school where my son goes and said, I need an itemized breakdown of everything that this kid's paying or that I'm paying, frankly, I don't know that they would necessarily be forthcoming, which makes a systemic fix seemingly impossible.
Yeah, so of course I agree with you. Consumer transparency is a huge issue. And it is my view, and I'm sure I'll get nasty comments about
this,
but it's my view that some colleges are purposely opaque, I would say, because it is in their interest to hide the true cost of their school, because otherwise you won't go, because it's so crazily expensive. The other part of the opacity is our own consumer psychology. There's something called the Chivas-Regal effect. Have you heard of that?
No, but I'm not a Chivas drinker.
Make us smart.
Okay. So in economics, they found that consumer psychology, if you price something, you know, very high, consumers assume that it has a quality associated with a high price. So colleges, you know, make their sticker price very high. And a growing number of them basically then give every single student who gets in a, quote, scholarship, which you can call a discount or whatever, you know, a presidential scholarship or a chancellor scholarship that sounds great, right? So the school has a $60,000 sticker price, but you're special. You get a $20,000 presidential scholarship. Now the kid's delighted. The parents have something to boast about. And they're still going to pay $40,000 a year for college, or $45,000 a year for college. So the college is happy. They're still getting a lot more money. And the student is happy because they have something to brag about. So this is a consumer marketing system that works. And so consumers partly have themselves to blame about the confusing difference between sticker price and net price.
I mean, how much in the kind of mix of reasons that there might be for prices, for tuition rising as much as it has, how much of that is a factor versus, I don't know, states not funding state schools? I mean, what did I see? Like, tuition at four-year public colleges has risen more than 100% since 2001. That's from a Washington Post piece last year.
Yeah, that's probably about right. right.
Yeah, do we know why?
Yeah, okay, so about 80% of undergraduates attend public universities. So for the vast majority of students, the reasons college costs have been rising have to do with declines in state subsidies per student. I mean, the amount of money states are spending on their higher education systems often has been rising just because the population is growing. But when you look at the per student subsidy, that's been declining, especially since the Great Recession. So the colleges have to make up that money somehow, and so they've been raising tuition, right? The other reason that colleges are getting more expensive is they're providing a lot more services, a lot more mental health services, a lot more tutoring because of problems. You know, we're seeing more students come in who are unprepared. So there's a lot more services that schools are providing. And then there's what I like to call resortification of campuses. I think we've all heard about the Lazy River. I think it's at Texas A&M or some school like that. You know, climbing walls and dorms are much nicer. I did a graduate program at Ohio State where after World War II, the returning GIs were, their housing was a barracks underneath the stadium, you know, in the underneath the risers in the stadium, right? They were literally living in barracks in the football stadium. Very basic accommodations. But now, you know, the dorms are much nicer, right? So, you know, you get maybe even a semi-private bathroom. So there's, you know, rising amenities on campuses as well.
So there's this thing called the tuition tracker, which I got turned on to as a result of the research for this article, which is fascinating, but or for this talk, which is fascinating. But one of the things that it didn't jump out, but after I poked around for a while, it became clear that the net price that a lot of people are paying does not seem to have gone up all that much over the past number of years, right? Sticker price is way up, but net price that most people are paying is not so much increased. How come?
That's true. The net prices are not rising as quickly as you might see as the sticker prices,
right.
But they're still rising.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they're still rising faster than incomes and inflation. So it's not as bad. The story isn't as bad as you might think, you know, when you hear about these crazy $75,000 prices, but it's still not a good story. And one reason that net prices are you know, moderating a little bit is that I think that, you know, they have a saying, no tree goes to the sky, right? Private colleges, I think, have really hit the ceiling. They just can't keep raising the prices the way they have been. And part of that is due to a decline, actually, in the number of 18-year-olds. There's been a slow decline in the birth rate over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years. And as a result, the number of traditional freshmen, especially in areas like New England, the Northeast, and the Midwest, have really sort of started plummeting. And so colleges are having to compete much more actively for the traditional freshmen. And this is only going to get worse. There was a dramatic drop in the birth rate in after the Great Recession. So 10 years from now, there's going to be a significant decline in the number of 18-year-olds, especially if we continue to limit the immigration as we have. I mean, colleges have been making up a lot of this decline in demand by bringing in students from Asia, especially China and India. But now that's getting so difficult, the colleges are having to scramble. You know, they can't fill those seats anymore. So they're having to really face a decline in basic demand.
That's like a whole separate episode that I think is super interesting. I have a couple of friends who are professors at Cal, and they've been saying that Cal is doing anything it can to bring in full-ride Chinese students.
Yep.
And like you said, it's getting harder and harder.
What do you think of the proposition, Kim, that and this is a little bit off topic, but not that far off, that the student debt crisis is the next thing that's going to kneecap this economy, like $1.something trillion in student debt out there?
Yeah, 1.3, 1.4, 5, somewhere. I don't know. It keeps rising.
Yeah.
Well, as long as the job market is good, you know, people who take on or just stick with their federal student loans, they're really going to max out at about $27,000, about $30,000 a year. You know, those are $200 a month payments, and you can get income-based repayment. Now, those people, if they stick with the federal loans, they're going to be okay. It's the people who take out the private loans, which are much more expensive, that are really stuck. And, you know, the people we started with who are all applying to these private schools, I mean, some of them, such as Columbia, they will, you know, if you're low income, you'll get a pretty close to a full ride. But some of them, like Scripps, maybe not so much. I mean, for the average low-income student who attends a private college, not a public, but a private college, and by low income, I mean their family income is less than $30,000 a year. Those students, on average, and you can find this in the tuition tracker, that website, the average low-income student is paying $20,000 a year for a private school education. Now, they're only doing that with private loans, and that means they those students are going to graduate with nearly, you know, six figures in student debt or maybe more. I just don't think that's a good solution. So the people at the top of the hour, I want to call them and tell them, please apply to a financial safety school. There's nothing wrong with the Cal States. You know, San Diego State, great school, hard to get into. There's nothing wrong with that. Cal State Northridge, one of the schools that has been identified as one of the best promoters of socioeconomic mobility in the country. A lot of great affordable colleges in California that are public. Please don't focus just on the private.
That's so interesting, the idea of a financial safety school. That's just brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah. Wow.
Kim Clark, Assistant Director of the Education Writers Association. Kim, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
thanks
you so
for
much.
Having me.
That was great.
You bet.
Wow. Also, somehow completely depressing. But that's just me.
No, there was good, useful advice in there. Check out, I have been playing with the tuition tracker, and it is really fascinating, primarily because, like we were saying at the top of our interview with her, the sticker price and the net price are so different. Mm-hmm. Like, I put in Princeton and then selected, you know, $30,000 to $48,000 income, net price $2,705.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those weird things where you can imagine that not having wage growth would be a better thing. Anyway, go play with it. Super interesting. I put in my alma mater. It's still nice and cheap. Tuitiontracker.org. It just went live last week, actually. It's brand new. And it's worth checking out.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be back.
Oh, hello. It's us again.
That's right. All right, who's going first? Who's going first on the fix? I'm going first. Okay. All right. So my the thing I can't stop thinking about, and really it's only been like the last, 24 hours since this actually happened in the news. My the thing I want to introduce my piece with is from Merriam-Webster, credulous. Mm-hmm. The word credulous. It's an adjective, ready to believe, especially on slight or uncertain evidence. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I mention that because of these headlines that have appeared in the last 24 hours in the mainstream media of the United States press, protected, I would say, also by the First Amendment. Not that that's relevant. From Vox.com, a reliable news organization, Trump says phase two tax cuts are coming for the middle class. From the New York Times, another tax cut, Trump and Republicans offer a midterm tax cut. From the Washington Examiner, Trump says major tax cuts for middle income people coming. And I could go on and on and on. The problem, of course, is that that's not grounded in reality. The president's stump speech the past like 10 days, and he's going to be doing more and more of these, he has been saying, in addition to the many other things he's been saying, is that he is going to get another tax cut before the election. The problem is, it's not real, right? Congress is out until after the election. Even Republicans are getting leery of how much debt is being piled on this economy, and there is no plan. And I'm just troubled by, and this is one of many examples, right? The tax cut is one. The whole idea of the caravan of migrants coming north being literally on the doorstep of the southern border of the United States, also not true. They're like 1,000 miles away. I'm a little disappointed in the mainstream media of this country right now because we're just not exercising due caution. The president, just because the president says, here's the moral, just because the president says it doesn't mean it's true.
Well,
which is kind of an amazing thing to say.
It shouldn't be amazing at this point. There is now at least one, I think it's the Washington Post, is that the one, the fact checker, that's like 2,000 items long, you know?
Yes.
I am really a big fan of the word credulous, and I like to follow it with the word ninny.
Oh.
As in, don't be such a credulous ninny.
Don't be a credulous
like, this
ninny.
Is an actual thing that I say all the time, and so I'm so delighted that you have this. And I will only add to your fixation that, yes, when the history of this time is written, the media, and by that I mean us, like that's fine, right?
Yep. Yep.
Will totally. Not come out looking good and shouldn't.
Nope.
When have they ever? I am going to point you to a really interesting piece. I was in Chicago last week for the Chicago Ideas Festival, and one of my panelists, yes. Jonathan Taplin, wrote the Harper's cover story this month in Harper's Magazine. And it's about, it's really, it was so timely in a way because because I met him in Chicago, which is the last time I was there, was with Kai Ryssdal to interview Rahm Emanuel about the role of cities in, you know, it was immediately after the presidential election. And cities mm-hmm. and states had clearly been drawing their battle lines, right, about where they stood in this post-Trump order. And we wanted to know what was going to be the role of cities as we grew increasingly divided. And that is what this whole piece is about. But it's about states specifically. So it's called Rebirth of a Nation, the essay that he wrote from the November 2018 issue. Can states' rights save us from a second civil war? Which is obviously a provocative subtitle. But it's super interesting because it talks about, I learned all about the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which stemmed in part from Thomas Jefferson's debates with James Madison during the Constitutional Convention. And he said, whoa, this Constitution needs a defensive measure against an autocratic federal government. And that is the 10th Amendment, which essentially says, you know, states have rights and they have rights to make their own laws. And so what the essay argues in part is that there will be this kind of rise in states such as California, setting themselves up as like semi-sovereign, I don't know, territories with their own beliefs and values. And you can choose to like live there or not. I don't know. It's a really interesting read.
There you go.
That's my fixation right now.
Mollywood's fix.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There you go.
All right.
All right. Next up is you guys.
Dear Make Me Smart.
This is Jess from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm David Stork of Portola Valley, California.
I'm a doctoral candidate.
I'm getting married this November.
I work for a Fortune 500 company.
Speaking of education,
yes,
which we have been, we're going to go back to one of our questions from the Explainathon. Becca Weinberg asked us whether Chromebooks used in schools are collecting data on our students. And I was like, I also want to know that. And if so, how are they doing it? Listener John Heinz is a former school lawyer who is now a teacher in China. Back in the day, he said he was at a workshop at a conference and saw how this could all play out in real time. And he left us a voicemail.
The reality is schools are in the same situation that everybody's in. When I was at this conference and getting this workshop, they created a nice little circle that began with, Billy putting in an email to his friend about the paper on Catcher in the Rye that he had due next week. And fast forward how the data goes to Google. Google aggregates it, sells it in a way that protects personally identifiable information by removing the names. Another organization buys the data and voila, the next day, Billy goes onto his Gmail account and there's an ad to buy a paper on Catcher in the Rye. There's no question that it's the same exact cycle that you've been talking about for a long time.
If you can't figure out what the product is you. Yeah.
That sound is me banging my head on the desk.
Lots of you had some very, very strong thoughts, and rightly so, about our smart home episode, mm-hmm. which was a week ago, I guess, although it seems longer than that. Good. But that's just time, I suppose. Steve Gammon had a very different take on Jordan Perry's original question about smart homes. Remember, the question was, I'm in this apartment and they're upgrading to smart homes and I worry about my privacy. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. I thought she was concerned about the landlord having all the data about her living habits since she had this technology installed without her expressed approval. This is a way different situation than a huge tech company collecting data about her activities in order to sell her something. What if the landlord decided to cut her AC because her pattern showed that she was out on a Saturday night? Maybe start charging extra rent because her door monitor shows she has pet food delivered monthly. I could go way down that dark hole, but I won't. I think local access to data is way more concerning than a conglomerate selling data to a third party.
What about just access to data, period, whether it's local or conglomerate? But that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people raise that concern, and I am kind of sorry that we didn't go down that road, except that I think there are real questions technically about how much data a landlord could access. But certainly, I get if you install a Nest, you get a little dashboard. So mm-hmm. if the landlord is able to say, like, I'm gonna start charging you a monthly utility bill when I didn't before because I think that you turned the heat up too high, those are real possibilities. And so thank you to everyone who raised those questions. I think that this landlord thing is not going to go away. I think we only scratched the surface on that, and it's true.
Hmm.
All right, Anna Oleska is concerned, however, about to your point, Kai. She said, mm-hmm. I don't care who's mm-hmm. collecting the data. I don't want them to do it. She said she is concerned about the conglomerates accessing your data. She's a data scientist and has seen this collection happen firsthand. This is going to be fun.
One of the assumptions that we probably have to make is if the data can be used for marketing or other purposes, sooner or later it will be used. It can also be sold to other interested parties. Working for Honeywell recently, I actually created multiple use cases for that type of data. So your home thermostat pattern or electricity usage pattern or HVAC pattern, they all are reported to the utility.
Repeat after me, people. You have no privacy. Get over it. I'm kidding, but I'm not. It's true. It's true, right? It's true. It's true. One last note on this. Joey Tyson says encrypted data for your smart home? Nah, it's not going to happen.
Encryption won't necessarily help if the devices are susceptible to hacking, as we've often seen with the Internet of Things. Attacks such as the Mirai botnet can spread virally by scanning for vulnerable devices.
We're doomed. Just saying.
Yeah, a guy named Daniel raised that point on Twitter, too, and that was really important as well. That is one thing if it's about the data being encrypted from, you know, source to endpoint, fine. But a lot of these devices themselves are vectors for hackers because they're super insecure. There's no way to, like, set a password on your internet-connected, you know, cameras. And even if there is, most people don't, and the security on them is pretty. So what several security experts pointed out is that because these are a vector, like someone can use it to find their way into your home network and then turn everything in your house into part of a botnet that is then, a botnet is basically a big collection of computers that usually are used to like crack passwords. Well, so good times.
What was I just saying? You have no privacy? Right. That's what I was just saying. Okay. Just checking. Look, we need a sting for Kai Goes to the Dark Place.
I know.
Didn't we have one?
Like
we
the nihilistic dark place. We need a dark place sting. Last but not least, we have our Make Me Smart question, which of course is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Elizabeth Owens left us this message about the things that your parents tell you.
Hey, Kai and Molly. Every week, I hear people's answers to the Make Me Smart question, and they're serious and thoughtful and wonderful. And every week, I try to think of my serious and thoughtful and wonderful answer. But honestly, the biggest thing I thought I knew stems from a childhood fascination with a syndicated columnist in our Sunday paper named Gary Deebs. I don't remember why, but I was smitten with him. My parents, super amused by my crush, began to tell me all sorts of things about Gary Deebs, including the tidbit that he drove an orange Volkswagen and sang Good Golly, Miss Molly. Well, into early adulthood, I fully believed it was Gary Deebs singing about rockin' and rollin', and it was much later than it should have been that I found out I was wrong about that. Thanks, guys. I love the show. Keep up the good work.
Wow. I don't even know what to do with that, but all right.
They told her that he was the singer of that song?
Yeah.
Oh, that is awesome. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say we're not all tempted to lie to our kids, but that's a good reminder not to. Just make stuff up. Also, nobody sings that song.
Oh, my goodness. All right, we are done here. The conversation does, however, continue. Join our Facebook group. Search Make Me Smart Podcast on Facebook. It'll be there. Lots of great conversations that we don't actually honestly have time to get to on the pod. More, obviously, about smart home episode. Join in on what I'm sure will be started about college tuition and how ridiculous it is. And we didn't even scratch the admissions part of that whole conversation, which is a whole other thing.
I know. Yeah. That's on the tuition tracker, too.
Yeah.
Wah, wah. Yeah. 7% admission rate at Princeton.
Yep.
Good times. The Facebook group, I do want to point out that, yes, we're aware of the cognitive dissonance of like talking a whole bunch about Facebook and how much we hate it and then sending you to the group. But I will say it is really fun, the Facebook group, after the Deep Sigh episode last week. And I know. Look, I know. This is the eternal paradox that is Facebook right now. But after our deep sigh episode last week, which Kai just did, I don't know if you heard it, someone posted this amazing meme of Kai next to the Greek letters Kai and Psi. So it's the Kai Psi.
That was pretty good. Get it to Kai Psi.
Make Me Smart podcast on Facebook. I'm just saying it's just worth it for that alone.
We're going. We're going.
That's all.
That was pretty funny. That was pretty funny, that Kai Psi thing. Pretty good.
It was hilarious.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer, the one who tells us when to tweet stuff. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, the one who plays the music and says, "Get moving, people." Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Why are you moving around in that Google Doc? I keep seeing you moving around like you're a little
The ones who tell us to do everything. Yeah.
Is that what you were going to say? God, it's like giving me some weird kind of seizure.
Look, I highlighted. Pew, pew.
Wow, purple. Why are you purple?
Collaboration. Boom.
Anyway, I don't even know.
Pew. Daniel and Ben are the ones who make us dance.
There will be no dance.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.